Preparing for the homecoming parade in the morning feels like sleepwalking through Monica 1.0's life. I don't recognize myself in the bathroom mirror as I go through my game makeup routine, applying false eyelashes and lining my lips in red. Everything is the same, but it's different. We're marching in the parade and performing to the marching band's music. It's a watered-down, simple routine centered on a kick line. Still, Coach ordered us to be in full competition dress, slicked-back buns, rhinestones adhered to the corners of our eyes. The parade starts in the high school parking lot. Once we're all here, Coach lines us up for inspection. The parking lot is filling rapidly with sports team members in uniform, band members carrying unwieldy instruments. A girl is blowing into a clarinet, tuning it shrilly. A whistle pierces through the din. Around the parking lot, people are dropping what they're doing to find the source of the noise. Mrs. Lin, the student council advisor, climbs onto the back of the pickup truck hitched to the senior class float. She sticks two fingers in her mouth and whistles again. Find your groups, please. Class court members should report to their floats. If you're marching and on homecoming court, find your class float at the end of the parade route for the crowning ceremony. The band launches into a practice run of Sunnybrook's fight song, and we run through the routine. They kick off the parade, us dancing behind them, and the other sports teams and the class floats bringing up the rear. When we reach the corner of Main Street, someone shouts my name from the crowd. My brother is jumping up and down, waving at me. He's camped outside of Eldon's Grocery with TJ Blake and his mother. The sidewalks are packed, and the police have the side streets blocked off. The crowd goes wild at our high kicks. While they're clapping, I sneak a wave at my brother. A flash of blonde hair, and our eyes connect. Me and Allie Lewandowski. She stares back at me, coldly, and I stumble, sashaying forward with the wrong foot. What is she doing here? She didn't go to Sunnybrook High School. She hasn't coached here for years. Paranoia wallops me as I entertain the idea that Allie being here has something to do with our meeting. I screw up the routine and add in an extra step, colliding with the dancer in front of me. We're at the end of the route, in the CVS parking lot. I can't think over the buzzing in my ears. Ginny. I have to find Ginny and tell her Allie is here. I wade through the crowd at the end of the route, looking for her strawberry blonde bun. We all look the same in our uniforms, our identical hairstyles. Someone grabs me by the shoulder, pulling me back. Monica, Alexa says, we have to go to the float for homecoming court. I open my mouth to give her an excuse, but the crowd starts going wild. The class floats are approaching the end of the route, a police officer directing the trucks pulling them into the parking lot. Alexa tugs on my hand, and we follow the junior class float. It's a giant papier-mâché of a shark head. Hanging between two palm trees is a banner reading, Grab Shrewsbury by the Jaws. The other court members are already on the float, plastic lays around their necks. The driver, one of the junior's parents, slows to a stop in front of CVS. Come on, come on! Mrs. Lin hurries over to Alexa and me, passing us each plastic lays. This part always annoys her, how all the girls on the team who make homecoming court choose dancing in the parade over riding on the float. Or at least she thinks we have the choice. One of the guys on the float holds a hand out to Alexa, helping hoist her up. Once she's settled, he reaches for me. I balk. Monica! Mrs. Lin snaps. I need you on that float so we can start the ceremony. The police have to reopen the road in 15 minutes. I decline the nomination, I say. Give it to someone else. Alexa stares from me to Mrs. Lin. Can she even do that? Before I can open my mouth, two guys on the float reach down and grab me by the forearms, pulling me up. Mrs. Lin hurries off to make sure the Kelseys, both on the homecoming court, have made it onto the senior class float behind us without incident. I rub my forearms, the skin smarting from where the guys grabbed me. The sight of the crowd gathering in the parking lot waiting for the coronation sends a shot of panic through me. I drape my lei over my head, heart hammering, scanning the throng of people for Allie Lewandowski. I finally spot her in front of the post office adjoining the CVS. She's standing next to a tall guy wearing a beanie and a Sunnybrook cross-country sweatshirt. He's almost a foot taller than she is. His head is turned to the soccer coach standing next to him, but his arm is around Allie's waist. Brandon. Brandon and Allie. Somewhere, someone is shouting into a bullhorn. And now, your junior class homecoming court! More cheers, nearly drowning out our names. When they get to mine, I try to duck behind Alexa, but it's too late. They've both seen me. Brandon is clapping, slowly, a deer caught in the headlights. Allie's arms are folded across her chest. They both seem oblivious to the fact that the other is staring straight at me. Chapter 20. Kelsey Butler and Joe Gabriel win homecoming queen and king. While they're being crowned, I hop off the float and wend my way through the dispersing crowd. The cop manning the end of the route is having little luck shooing people out of the street. I pass through the CVS parking lot and out onto the sidewalk, keep walking until I spot them in front of the playhouse. Ginny and my brother. Petey is talking a mile a minute, and she's smiling down at him, nodding along. Always a good sport. Where's Mom? I ask Petey when I catch up with them.
At home, doing work. TJ's mom brought me.
Ginny's eyes meet mine. She can tell I'm upset. I shake my head. Not here. I put a hand on Petey's shoulder.
Can you go find TJ? Ginny and I have to be somewhere for dance team. But she downloaded Clan Wars. I was telling her about the update, he whines.
Petey, please. He gives me a frosty look and trudges off to where TJ and Mrs. Blake are chatting with a woman outside of Alden's. Ginny's voice is in my ear. What's the matter? I nod to the alley walkway between the playhouse and the library. Ginny and I slip down it and emerge in the rear parking lot. Allie Lewandowski's here, I say, with Brandon, the cross-country coach. I can't tell if she's putting two and two together, seeing me inside Brandon's office and my reaction to seeing him here with Allie today. My calling him Brandon and not Mr. Michelson, like everyone else does. If Ginny knows, she doesn't say anything. But her face is grim. Last night, I poked around online a little. I tried to find the names of guys from the Sunnybrook area who also graduated from Hamilton the year before the murders. My mouth goes dry. There were only three guys who met the criteria. One of them is Brandon Michelson. Ginny eyes me. I looked into him more and found him on Newton High West's athletic records website. Allie was on it too. She graduated the year before. She got a scholarship to Oneonta for cheerleading. I lower myself to the curb, sit, and lean forward, resting my elbows on my knees. If Brandon was dating Allie at the time of the murders, it doesn't mean he's involved. Carly had said Allie's boyfriend's friend was the one who was selling pills. He was the one Juliana was afraid of. But Brandon knew. If Carly was telling the truth, Brandon was in the car when the other guy stopped to make a deal. Brandon helped his friend beat the shit out of the guy who ratted him out. It was 5 years ago. People change. A dueling voice in my head jumps in. He was still older than you are now. He knew better. It doesn't matter. I whisper it, as if saying it out loud will make it true. It doesn't matter who Brandon was back then, because nothing is going on between Brandon and me anymore. You made out with him in his car during the memorial. I bury my face in my hands, breathe deeply for a minute before I look up at Ginny. Brandon was Allie's boyfriend, and his best friend was the drug dealer. Carly didn't say which one the pickup truck belonged to. So what do we do?
Ginny says. I don't know. We have no proof of anything. We have a rumor from Carly that Brandon was friends with a drug dealer who may have possibly killed Juliana and Susan. We have a dead man's statement that he saw a pickup truck that night. And then a story about someone fighting with Juliana on the deck that the cops already think is a lie. I rub my eyes. Who is going to believe us? Ginny's mouth forms a line. Shouts of excitement echo in the alley behind us. People are filtering through it, heading for their cars parked in the lot. Congratulations! A man accompanied by a trio of kids gives me a thumbs up. It takes me a moment to remember the lei around my neck. When he and the kids are loaded into their car, I tear the lei off. I can't do this, I tell Ginny. I can't go to the game or the dance and act like everything is normal. You have to, she says. There's nothing we can do right now. You're just going to make your mom and stepdad more worried about you. She's right. My eyes prick with tears. Can you come? I know you didn't get a ticket to the dance, but you can come to Kelsey's party. The faintest trace of a smile passes over Jenny's lips. Monica, that would be the exact opposite of acting like everything is normal. To everyone's surprise, Sunnybrook defeats Shrewsbury 50-44. It's the first homecoming game we've won in 4 years. As a result, the mood at the dance is even more raucous than normal. Three seniors are thrown out for showing up drunk, and all night teachers have to pry people off each other for violating the no grinding rule. Alexa is breathless on the ride back to her house, undaunted by the fact that Mrs. Coughlin reamed her out for dancing inappropriately with Joe Gabriel, even going so far as to threaten to tell Coach. I love him, Alexa says, lowering the window and tilting her face to the cool night air. I'm going to lick his face tonight. You're demented. He's a douchebag. Rach isn't looking at either of us, her eyes on the road. She's been quiet all day. It worries me. Her being this moody means she's more likely to get obliterated at Kelsey's party. They bicker all the way to Alexa's about whether or not Joe Gabriel is a douchebag. I can't keep up. Brandon won't stop invading my thoughts. The look on his face when he saw me at the parade. Was he just nervous, having me in proximity of his girlfriend? Or does he know I talked to Allie last week, and he's panicking because I asked her about Carly Amato? Rach, Alexa, and I head straight upstairs when we get to the Santiago's. I park myself on the edge of Alexa's bed, peeling off the glittery flats I wore to the dance. We're staying here tonight. Alexa's mom is always saying that she knows we drink, and if we're going to do it anyway, she'd rather we have a safe ride home. Rachel and I don't have chill moms. They think we're sleeping at the Santiago's tonight and braiding each other's hair or whatever. Tom gave me a look and a sigh when I told him and my mom I was staying here. While Rachel strips off her homecoming dress, replacing it with skinny jeans, I get my phone out of my purse. I have a missed text. I recognize the number as Brandon's. Need to talk to you. I try to control my breathing as I type out a response. About what? I can't wear this. Rachel is studying herself in Alexa's full-length mirror, running her hands over her glittery black tank top. My boobs are falling out. It's that stupid juice cleanse. Alexa is winding a lock of hair around her wave iron. My phone vibrates. I think you know what. I pocket my phone, feeling sick. He knows I talked to Allie. If she told him everything, he may have put the pieces together. He might know I've been looking into the murders. Here, wear this. It's going to be freezing by the lake anyway. Alexa tosses Rach a boat neck sweatshirt. She tugs it over her tank top, examines herself in the mirror. Just don't let anything happen to that one, Alexa says, turning back to freshening up her waves. I like it. Rach's face darkens, no doubt thinking of the dance team sweatshirt she borrowed from Alexa and lost. I shrug out of my dress, almost positive Rach and Alexa can hear my heart racing. I want to talk to Ginny, but I'll have to tell her why Brandon Michelson has my phone number. I just won't respond to him. He can't push it, can't try to corner me at school on Monday, not without having to answer uncomfortable questions about our relationship. The thought soothes me enough to laugh as Mrs. Santiago and Rachel taunt Alexa about Joe on the car ride to the Gabriel's house. Kelsey lives on a secluded estate on the north side of Osprey Lake. It's one of those houses that have a driveway with a gate. Her back deck overlooks the lake and has a hot tub. Almost everyone is inside because it's 40 degrees out, probably the coldest night of the season so far. A few brave morons are in the hot tub. The party is a shit show. Rachel is drunk within 15 minutes of our arrival, and Alexa is stuck to the beer pong table like a barnacle. I leave her and make myself a vodka cranberry in the kitchen. Drain it in two gulps, hoping it will loosen me a bit, before I'm dragged into a group of dance team girls. "We're doing a shot together," one of them crows. I don't fight it. When we're done, I do a lap around the house for Rachel. Unable to find her, I pour another drink and head back to the garage. Alexa is still at the beer pong table. I watch her play against Joe Gabriel and another senior guy. "Hey." Jimmy Varney sidles up next to me, a can of Diet Coke in hand. "Is there rum in there, at least?" I'm surprised at the effort it takes to get the words out. I look down at the dregs of my vodka cranberry. My head is fuzzy, and I can't remember if it was my second or third. No, definitely second. I always stop after two. The shot I did, though, that was a mistake. Jimmy smiles. "Driving," he says. "Rachel Steger is looking for you." Disappointment needles me. Is that the only reason he sought me out? I'm immediately disgusted with myself. My pathological need for attention from guys is why I'm in this mess with Brandon. "Thanks," I say. "I'll go find her, I guess." Jimmy nods to the beer pong table. "Partners next game?" Before I can respond, my back pocket vibrates. I set my drink down and scramble to get my phone out, my fingertips numb from the cold garage. I turn away from Jimmy so he can't see the message from Brandon. "I'm parked down the block. Can you come out? We need to talk. Now." My heart comes to a full stop. The noise in the garage dulls. I lean against the wall for support. Jimmy rests a hand on my upper back. "Mon, are you okay?" "Yeah, fine. I need to get something from inside." I head up the stairs into the house at the same moment Rachel is stepping down into the garage, wobbling on her heels like a newborn giraffe. Her eyes, mascara already smudged, lock on me.
"Babe, what you doing?"
"I have to go somewhere for a minute," I say, sidestepping her.
"I'll be right back."
Rachel pouts.
"But where are you going?"
"Outside for a minute. I'll be right back."
"Can I come?"
"No." It comes out more forceful than I intended.
"Jesus, Rach, I'll be right back."
Rach takes a step back at the forcefulness of my voice. Her cup sways with her, splashing cranberry juice down Alexa's sweatshirt.
"No."
She screws up her face like a toddler who dropped her ice cream in the dirt.
"No, no, no."
"It's okay," I say. "Ask Kelsey if she has seltzer."
"Alexa is going to kill me. I'm always borrowing her shit and losing it or ruining it."
That's when something in me snaps.
"Rachel, you need to get a grip."
She bursts into tears. Alexa, who has been watching us from the pong table, looks at me like I'm a monster. I'll have to apologize later, but right now, I need to get the hell out of here before anyone sees Brandon's Jeep. How the hell could he come here? Does he realize how stupid that is? If he's caught near a high school party... My gut clenches at the sight of Brandon's Jeep parked at the end of the cul-de-sac, his lights off. I rap on the window. He lowers it. Door's unlocked. I think I'll stay out here. I wrap my arms around my midsection. Brandon sighs, turns his engine off.
Fine.
I take a step back as he gets out of the Jeep. He rakes his hair off his forehead and looks at me.
You talked to Allie. What the fuck, Monica?
It wasn't even about you. I didn't know you two were together.
Still, he says, do you realize what could happen if she finds out?
I'm not going to tell her anything. Are we done here? Good. Bye. I suddenly realize that I am drunk and need to remove myself from this situation. When I turn to leave, Brandon grabs my wrist.
Wait. Why were you asking Allie about Carly Amato?
My knees are quaking beneath me. I press my legs together to still them. You and Allie were together when she was the cheerleading coach, weren't you? Brandon is quiet.
I don't know where you're going with this.
Just answer the question, Brandon.
You're obviously wasted, he says. Why don't you let me take you home?
It occurs to me that he's still holding me by the wrist.
Get the hell away from me!
I yank my arm away from him so forcefully that I pull a muscle in my shoulder. Brandon takes a step back, holds his hands up.
Jesus, Monica.
Don't ever come near me again, I say.
He gets back into the car, and I start crying. I collapse on the lawn of the house Brandon parked outside, and I call my mom. My mother looks deeply unamused as she pulls up outside Kelsey's house. I yank open the passenger door and stumble in. Mom sniffs.
How much did you drink?
2 vodka cranberries and a shot. She sighs and pulls away from the house. I lean back in the seat, eyes closed, tears pooling under my lids. Once we're home, she turns off the engine, but she doesn't move to get out of the car. Finally, she speaks.
Just tell me what to do. I'm out of ideas.
My throat is dry and scratchy. I swallow, but I can't find any words. The sobs come out of me like violent, dry heaves.
I hate myself.
I don't know what she was expecting me to say, but that wasn't it. She flinches, like I've cursed at her. I can't stand looking at her, so I cover my face in my hands and cry. It's an ugly, awful sound. Any louder, and Tom and Petey could probably hear from inside the house.
Monica, listen to me.
I hiccup, gulp for air. My mother says my name again. She grabs me and holds my head to her shoulder. She rocks me like a child and lets me cry.
I hate who I am. I hate myself so much.
Monica, she says, still cradling me. Even at your worst, I love you more than life itself. Mom makes me drink a full bottle of water before I go up to bed. I eye my bathroom, but I'm not ready to throw up yet. I stumble to my bed and text Ginny. He came to Kelset GS Brandon. My phone starts vibrating moments later. She's calling me. I hit accept. Ginny's voice is soft in my ear. Monica, I couldn't understand your texts. Are you drunk?
Yes, I say. Brandon came to Kelsey's party. We argued, and I told him to stay away from me.
Monica, hold on. Brandon Michelson?
Yes. Allie's boyfriend.
How did he... What was he doing showing up at Kelsey's party to talk to you?
I fucked up so bad. I whimper and hiccup, and Ginny cuts me off by saying my name.
Monica, look, it's not your fault. He's so much older. Monica, you understand what happened to you, right?
I know. I think I have to tell Tom everything.
Is he awake now?
No. I think I should wait until the morning. He's not going to believe me when I'm like this.
Ginny, I say,
I don't deserve a friend like you.
I don't know what she says in response because the room around me spins into darkness. I wake up ready to throw up and stumble into my bathroom. Not much comes out. I flush the toilet and lie back against the vanity, not ambitious enough to stand just yet. Finally, I'm ready to drag myself back to bed. Before I get comfortable, I check my phone. It's only 2 a.m. I must have passed out briefly after ending my call with Ginny. I have a text from Rachel, time-stamped almost an hour ago. Babe, you okay? Someone said your mom picked you up. I'm sorry I was such an asshole. I got the juice off Lex's shirt with seltzer. I text her back, my eyes tight, cheeks stiff with tears. I'm the asshole. I love you. I wish I were piled onto Alexa's bed with my friends. On a normal night, we would be laughing by now at Rach's lack of ability to give us back anything she borrows. Earrings, sweatshirts, books. We don't know where it all goes, but we keep lending her shit anyway because that's what friends do. I jolt, sitting up straight and banging my head on my headboard. A single thought crystallizes. Something is wrong. Why can't I figure out what's wrong? Brandon and Carly. Brandon was not cheating on Allie with Carly. Allie said the guys shouldn't have been hanging out with a high school girl. Not girls. Allie didn't know about Juliana. Brandon didn't want her to know about Juliana. I cover my mouth, whimper, tasting bile coming back up my throat. I made myself delete the picture a few weeks ago. I took it at work this summer. Brandon on the lifeguard stand, sticking his tongue out at me playfully. I fumble for my phone. My trash bin stores deleted pictures for 30 days. I zoom in on Brandon's tan and muscular legs. It feels like my bed is bottoming out. Just above his right ankle, on his calf, is a crescent-shaped white scar, the size of a bite from a large dog. Chapter 21. I wake up face down on my bed, still in the outfit I wore to Kelsey's party. My phone tells me it's almost noon. I head downstairs, every step rattling my brain. I want to die. My brother is on the living room couch, watching an Avengers movie. An explosion on screen makes the throbbing in my head quicken. Where is everyone? I ask. Dad is at the range, and Mom is at her play, duh. A fresh wave of panic hits me. My parents left Petey and me alone. Of course they did. It's broad daylight on Sunday, and we're not infants. They don't know what happened last night. Maybe Ginny was right, and I should have woken Tom up to tell him everything. They said you have a hangover, and I shouldn't wake you up, but if you do, I'm supposed to tell you not to set one foot outside this house, Petey says. Got it. I massage my temples. I plod into the kitchen, wincing at the light coming in through the window over the sink. Water. I need to rehydrate, maybe force some food down so I can take a Tylenol. The sound of a car door shutting makes me freeze. Maybe Tom,
back from the range already. I look out the window, but the driveway is empty. There's a knock at the door leading from the kitchen into the garage. Tom must have left the garage door open when he left. I swallow back the urge to vomit. I creep over to the door, opening it the slightest crack. Brandon stares back at me. My stomach plummets.
"I just want to talk," he says.
I have a flash of him at Susan Berry's back door. "You need to leave before I call my stepdad," I say. "Did I mention he's a cop?"
"And tell him what?"
There's panic in Brandon's voice.
"You have the wrong idea about everything."
I think about my brother lounging on the couch, Mango curled at his feet, unable to hear the knock at the door because of the volume of his movie. I angle myself so Brandon can't see me and fumble until I find the sound recording app on my phone and hit start. I slip my phone into my pajama pants pocket and step into the garage, pulling the door shut behind me.
"What do you want, Brandon?"
His name tastes foul in my mouth, but I need some way to prove it's him on the recording.
"I'm sorry about last night. I was out of line."
His eyes are pink around his pupils, the skin underneath them gray and shiny.
"But we need to talk about why you care so much about Carly Amato and Allie."
"You know why I care about them." I think of the security cameras Tom never got. Did anyone see Brandon come here? Will it even matter if he drags me out of here and gets me into his car? My brother won't hear my scream over the movie, and if he does, I have no idea what Brandon will do to him.
"Monica, whatever you're thinking, it's wrong."
"So you didn't cheat on Allie with Juliana Ruiz?" His reaction to her name is all the confirmation I need. He flinches, and his expression hardens. The lightest twitch in his jaw. I almost buckle over. I'm right. The earring, Carly's earring.
"I met her through Carly," Brandon says. "It was stupid of me. I ended it quickly."
"The night she was killed, right? Someone saw you outside Susan's house." Brandon's lips part. I'm shaking so hard. His eyes drop to my pocket, from which I've forgotten to remove my hand. Realization dawns on his face.
"Are you recording this?"
He takes a step toward me at the same moment the kitchen door opens. I whip around. Petey is standing in the doorway. He looks from Brandon to me.
"Who is that?" "No one. Go back inside, Petey."
I pull Brandon aside by the arm, my pulse ticking in my ears. "He knows you were here, what you look like. You're not a kid killer, Brandon. Please just leave and I'll pretend you were never here." Brandon's eyes flick from me to my brother, who hasn't moved.
"Please," I say quietly. "You didn't think this through. He's just a kid. And if you take me, he'll be able to lead the cops straight to you. You won't get away with it."
A bead of sweat crops up on Brandon's lip. I've gotten through to him. He's not a kid killer. When I feel the tension leave his body, I knee him in the balls and scream for Petey to run.
"Go straight to Ginny's house, number 84. Call the police there."
Brandon doubles over and yelps with pain. He stands up straight as I'm stumbling toward Tom's workbench and grabs me by the shoulder. He's hurting. I can hear it in his labored breathing. I could probably fight him off, but I need to give my brother a head start. I struggle against Brandon, keeping my eye on the open garage door. As soon as I spot Petey running down the street, I twist and elbow Brandon in the face. When I start to scramble away from him, pain sears the back of my head. He has me by the ponytail. I scream as he yanks me to a stop. He covers my mouth with one hand. I bite him, hard. While he recoils, I grab Petey's baseball bat off the rack next to the workbench. I use one hand to keep the bat pointed at Brandon.
"You move, I bash your head in. Hands up."
Brandon complies. The hand where I bit him is pink, blood drops forming where my teeth met his flesh.
I think of Susan Berry's dog, trying to stop Brandon from smothering her. I tighten my grip around the bat.
Sit there!
I nod to the rack where we keep our dirty shoes. Brandon obeys.
Okay, I say. You said you wanted to talk. Talk.
He winces, from the pain in his groin, his hand, or both.
I don't know what I'm supposed to say.
Why'd you kill them? I ask. Did Juliana threaten to tell Allie? Brandon shuts his eyes, muttering, Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. He probably thought this moment would never come. I hit him in the kneecap with the bat, yelling over his moaning and cries of, Oh my God.
Why did you kill them, Brandon? It wasn't just about Allie finding out. I was 22 and Juliana was 15, he says. If she told anyone, I could have gone to jail. You should know that.
The snideness that's crept into his voice makes me want to hit him in the knee again, harder.
What happened that night?
I told Juliana we had to stop the morning after Allie found the earring in my truck. Juliana was really, really mad. She thought I would break up with Allie for her. She didn't get it, that I couldn't be with a 15-year-old.
Brandon swallows.
She asked me to come to Susan's house to talk. We sat in my truck. It was fine at first, but when I told her again I wasn't leaving Allie, she started crying and yelling about how she was going to tell her. She got out and slammed the door.
You followed her inside. Brandon closes his eyes. Tears drip down his face over his lips.
She wouldn't answer the front door. When she said she was going to call the cops, I freaked. I climbed the fence and I saw the back door. She saw me and opened it and started yelling at me. When I followed her into the house, she went nuts. I was afraid Susan would hear, so I covered Juliana's mouth. She bit me, and when she jerked away, she fell back into the mirror. Her head was bleeding, and she came at me with a shard. I just panicked.
So instead of calling to get Juliana help, you killed her and Susan.
Susan heard. She came downstairs at the noise. She started running back upstairs when she saw everything, so I ran after her and grabbed her.
Brandon chokes out a sob.
I didn't go there planning to hurt anyone. It just got out of control.
You're disgusting, I scream. It was all an act with me, wasn't it? You pretended sleeping with me was a bad idea because of my age, while you were really a fucking He lunges at me, mashing his fist into my mouth before I can lift the baseball bat. I stumble back, but he presses his forearm into my throat, pinning me to the wall. When he reaches for the bat, I throw it as far as my short reach will allow. It clatters when it hits the ground, but Brandon doesn't go after it. His eyes are locked on me. I'm staring back at a cornered animal.
Is this what you did to her?
I gasp. Black spots are swimming before my eyes. Then, screaming. His screaming. He releases me, stumbling backward. I'm bent over, clutching my throat, trying to process the scene in front of me. Ginny is standing over Brandon, the bat in her hands. She's calm, her hands steady around its neck. Brandon is on his back, not moving.
Where's my brother?
It comes out garbled. My lips are swollen and my mouth tastes like blood.
Where's Petey?
He's at my house. We called 911 and Tom. I look from Ginny to Brandon. It's just the three of us now. I don't hear sirens yet. Brandon is watching me from the floor, his temple leaking blood. I realize that Ginny hit him in the head with the bat. Brandon's eyelids flutter. He needs an ambulance. He has a concussion, or worse. I look at Ginny again.
Give me the bat.
Monica, she says.
Please.
Ginny hands it over. Brandon's eyes roll back. He's finally passed out, either from the pain or from the sight of me standing over him with the bat. He must see it in my face. How badly I want to kill him. I've never wanted anything more in my life. it would just take a few swings. My fingers tremble around the handle of the bat. I look at Jenny. Her face is calm. If you do it, I'll say whatever you want. She'll tell everyone it was self-defense, that I had no choice but to kill Brandon. I want to. A tear slips out of my eye. I want it so bad. I know, Jenny says. The thoughts swirl through my head, landing on what my mother said to me last night in her car. Even at your worst, I love you more than life itself. She will still love me if I execute Brandon right here. I know Tom would, too, and maybe even Petey as well. But the Ruizes, the Berries, all the people whose lives he destroyed, they deserve the chance to look Brandon in the face as well. If I take that from them, I won't be able to live with myself. Brandon's eyes open again. I hold his gaze as I kick him in the stomach. I keep kicking and kicking until I'm out of breath, until a siren blares from down the street, until my foot's gone numb and Jenny has to drag me away from his limp body. Chapter 22. We can go home now. Tom's voice snaps me out of my trance. He sets his phone down on his desk and rubs his eyes. My mother has pulled her seat so close to mine, she is practically on top of me. When Tom speaks, her grip on my shoulder tightens. What about him?
Being treated? Won't be able to talk to him until tomorrow, most likely.
Why is he getting medical care? Mom demands. He should be in a cell. Tom shuts his eyes, holds up a hand.
Phoebe, please.
I touch the tender skin on my neck where Brandon tried to choke me. The first responder is said to expect nasty bruises there. They checked me for any serious injuries at the house and cleared me, which is the only reason my mother let me skip going to the hospital. I saw them carting Brandon off to the hospital. I can't be in the same building as him. I don't even want to breathe the same air as Brandon Michelson. A flutter of panic. They can't let him go, right?
They have enough to keep him for assault.
Tom doesn't look at me as he says it, but my mother moves her hand to mine.
They'll move to charge him for that and the statutory rape as soon as possible.
My mother flinches at the last part. What about the murders? I ask. I have him recorded practically confessing.
Once they finish up interviewing Jenny about what happened today, someone is going to talk to you again. After that, the DA will want to hear from you.
Tom massages his beard.
I've been asked to step aside while they investigate.
My eyes go prickly. If Brandon is charged with Juliana's and Susan's murders, the department will reopen the inquiry into Jack Canning's death. Tom could lose his job. I'm sorry, I say. All of this is my fault. My mother moves her hand to my knee and squeezes. Stop it. She's crying, and I'm crying, and soon Tom is crying and wrapping his arms around both of us, and we're all crying. What if Jen knew it was him? What if she knew, and he found out, and he made it look like she did it herself? Monica. My mom tightens her grip on me. She left a note. Jen left a note. She mentioned you. She wanted you to see California for her. Stop, I say. Please stop. Honey, no, you have to understand. I'm sobbing too hard to get out what I want to tell her. I'll never understand. I wake in my bed to my mother's hand on my forehead and sunlight assaulting my eyelids. Jenny's here if you want to see her. I sit up. What time is it? Almost 10, I wanted to let you sleep. Do you want me to send her up?
My head is throbbing.
No, I'll come downstairs.
Ginny is on my living room couch. She cranes her neck, stands when she sees me. I wave a hand.
Sit, sit.
Ginny lowers herself onto the couch, and I plop down next to her.
God, this hurts so bad.
Your neck? That, and everything else.
Yeah.
I just wanted you to know. I didn't tell the police anything, she says. Well, obviously I told them stuff, but not the last part of yesterday.
Thanks.
But you don't have to lie for me anymore. I pinch the bridge of my nose until I see white. Everyone's going to find out about Brandon and me. My life is pretty much over anyway.
You didn't do anything wrong.
Ginny's voice is soft.
He used you, like he used Juliana.
I used him. I was tired of being numb, and I wanted to prove to myself I could feel something. Ginny is quiet for a moment. Then,
did you?
I do now. I don't realize I'm crying until Ginny throws her arms around me. Tom said to expect the murder case to move slowly. When the news breaks, Brandon is being charged with statutory rape and assault. There's no mention in the news of Juliana's and Susan's murders. There's no mention of Brandon Michelson's unnamed victim, but everyone at school knows it's me. I'm not sure who figured it out, but it doesn't take a detective to put everything together. My two-day absence starting the morning that Brandon was fired from Sunnybrook High, rumors already swirling that he'd been arrested. Rachel and Alexa are the only ones I've told outside of Ginny and my family. They shield me on the way inside the school building. When the news broke last night, my mother said I could stay home today, but there's something I've been meaning to do. Instead of nasty looks and a scarlet letter painted on my locker, I arrived to sympathetic smiles. I suspect Rach and Alexa did damage control. I am a victim, whether or not I feel like one. Maybe one day I will wake up crushed under the weight of what Brandon did to me. For now, all I feel is the memory of that baseball bat hitting his body and my foot in his ribs. At the end of the day, before dance team practice starts, I find Coach in the athletic office, filling out registration forms for the upcoming competition. She looks up at me. She doesn't seem surprised to see that I'm not dressed in my dance clothes. I quit, I say. I should have done it sooner, but you have a week before regionals to rework the spots. Coach works the top of her pen with her thumb, giving it a click.
Are you sure this is what you want?
I couldn't eat the morning after dance team tryouts freshman year. I tried to strike a deal with God. If I make the team, I promise I'll be nicer to Mom and Petey and give all my Christmas money to the animal shelter. I'd never wanted anything so badly. Freshman year Monica would want to punch me in the face. Yes, I tell Coach. She blinks at me, the ghost of a smile on her lips, before going back to her paperwork. You're all right, Rayburn. I don't know which way she means it. But when I leave her office, I feel lighter than I did when I stepped inside. I catch the 3:30 bus home from school. The days are getting shorter. It feels strange being home before dark. As I climb the driveway, I see my mother's silhouette in the window, hanging a strand of orange holiday lights. The outside of the house looks different, too. She's stretched cotton cobwebs over the bushes, and a skeleton in a top hat hangs off the hook on the front door. When the door clicks shut behind me, Mango starts barking. My mom pops her head into the foyer, the tangle of Halloween lights in hand. You're home! I quit dance team. She comes to my side, draping an arm around my shoulder and pulling me in for a hug. I'm almost as tall as she is now. I let her squeeze me for a solid minute before putting my hands on her shoulders and gently pushing her away. Do you need help with the lights? After the lights are strung, I head up to my room and shrug out of my jeans, replacing them with pajama pants. I plop into my desk chair and open up my email, bracing for anonymous hate messages about what a life-ruining slut I am. I only have one message, and it's from Daphne Furman. My heartbeat skips. There's no way she knows that I'm the Sunnybrook High victim. There was no mention of Brandon's connection to the cheerleader murders in the media. The gears in my head grind to a halt when I see the subject line. Phil Cordero. I pull my feet onto my desk chair and tuck them under me. Hi, Monica. My contact had a tough time with this one. He couldn't find any record of employment, taxes, or incarceration for Phil Cordero in the last 5 years. 4 years ago, his wife filed a request to have him declared dead, but it looks like the judge denied it. The record shows that Phil's wife posted a $5,000 bail for a previous DUI charge he was set to appear for before he disappeared. Unrelated to the domestic violence charge, this guy seems like a real winner. If a defendant dies before a case goes to trial and bail is paid in cash, whoever posted the bail can get the money back. It's pretty difficult to provide proof of death without a body or evidence that a person met foul play. Anyway, the motion to have Phil declared dead states that the last time his wife saw him was the morning of October 27th. Several other people saw him at a bar that evening. I'm sure you've realized that this means Phil Cordero was last seen a full week before the murders. I'm sorry. I know you were hoping this would turn into a viable lead. I'll admit that I was too. My guess? Phil Cordero was facing upward of 15 years in prison for the domestic violence charges and the DUI and fled. Wherever he's hiding, he's doing a good job of it. Probably shacked up with some poor woman who has no idea what he did. Let me know if there's anything else I can do to help. Best, Daphne. I read it again to make sure I have it right. Ginny said her father left on October 18th, a full 3 days before this report says he was last seen. Either Ginny has the date her dad went missing wrong, or she lied about it. Ginny's father was last seen the night of Bethany and Colleen's accident. I wake up on the morning of the anniversary of Jen's death feeling different than I did last year. The numbness that I always feel is still there, but I can feel too. I can cry, so I do, in the shower. Rachel texts me that she's outside while I'm still dabbing concealer over my dark circles. I stick the wand back in the tube, stare at myself in the mirror, watching the rise and fall of my chest as I exhale. No one at school, aside from Rach and Alexa, is delicate with me today. They don't know what today is, and that's fine by me. I don't want to be treated as if I'm breakable. When I stop by my locker at the end of the day and find Jimmy Varney waiting for me, my breath gets caught in my throat. His older brother was in Jen's grade. He must remember. He must be here to say how sorry he is, how he's been thinking about my family and me today. The last thing I'm expecting him to say is, "Do you want to go to Big Heroes?" "Now?" "Well, rumor has it you quit dance team, and seeing how I don't have a cross-country coach anymore, I figured we're both free this afternoon." He must sense how I stiffen at the mention of Brandon. "Monica," he says softly, "I don't care about that." I meet his eyes. "This is just a sandwich among friends?" "A sandwich among friends. That's it. As long as it's a Louisiana Lightning." I smile. "Obviously." Jimmy doesn't needle me at all for details about the events of the last few weeks. In fact, he seems to be going out of his way to prove that he doesn't care about anything that happened between Brandon and me. Once our sandwich is ready, he must be able to tell that I don't want to eat in the busy deli, because he asks if I want to go somewhere quieter. What about Osprey's Bluff? I say. He agrees, and we spend the ride talking about his college options. He's being scouted by SUNY Binghamton, where Matt goes, but Jimmy doesn't want to go there because Matt says it smells like cows. Jimmy turns onto Osprey Road. On the other side of the street, I spot several wilted bouquets of flowers, including a hot pink bunch of tiger lilies, Bethany's favorite. Can you pull over here? Jimmy parks on the shoulder, a safe distance from the road and the sign reading, In Memory of Bethany Steger and Colleen Coughlin. Jimmy stands, his back against the car, feet crossed at the ankles, arms folded. He doesn't ask what I'm doing as I cross the street to the side overlooking the lake. The guardrail is weathered, but there is the faintest trace of red paint on it. The steep embankment slopes all the way to the edge of Osprey Lake. It would be so easy for a speeding car to fly over that guardrail and roll down into the lake. I think of Ginny's visceral reaction to Mrs. Coughlin in the yearbook office that day. The way Ginny went out of her way to avoid Rachel that fall. I swallow, shoot one last look at the lake before rejoining Jimmy at his car. What's the matter? Jimmy says, seeing my face. Absolutely nothing at all. When I get home and search the mail, there's no letter from Ethan McCready. There is no reason for him to write to Tom asking if he cares about the truth. The truth is out there now. But I text him anyway. No letter today. He responds right away as if he was waiting to hear from me. You sound surprised. No. Grateful, maybe. After a minute goes by without a response, I text him again. Why did she call you that morning? We listened to part of a book together. She wanted to know how it ended. Did you tell her? I said I'd tell her when I saw her next. I cover my mouth, hold in a sob while a tear trickles down my face over my hand. She knew she was going to die that day. Knowing it for sure doesn't make it hurt less. I blink away my tears and read the message that's just come through from Ethan. Thank you. For what? He doesn't reply for several minutes. Because maybe now I can let her go. It sends a fresh wave of hope through me. Maybe Ethan is right, and now we can all move on. We can forget about the heinous act and what it did to us, and in the process, the burden of missing the girls might just become a little lighter. I make a promise to myself to try to move on, to think about them a little less every day. I'll never forget Bethany and Colleen and Juliana and Susan and Jen. I can't, because my story is tied up in theirs forever. Ginny. 5 years ago, October. She always loved the way the rain looked when it hit the windshield of her father's truck. It was only a gentle mist, but the forecast called for a thunderstorm later. Where are we going? Ginny asked. Even though she knew the answer. It was a Friday night and her mother was working at the hospital. The last time she came home at 2 a.m. and found Ginny on the couch, watching infomercials on Nickelodeon, Daddy nowhere to be found, Mom called and said she'd kill him if he ever left her daughter alone again. He came home from the bar, stinking of cigarette smoke and cheap whiskey. Mom told Ginny to go to her room, to her closet that locked from the inside. In the morning, Mom's eye was purple and swollen, and when she got up from the kitchen table, her spine went stiff and her face pinched like she was trying not to cry. This time, she went to the emergency room for a broken wrist, taking Ginny with her. This time, when the hospital social worker asked if she should call the police, Ginny's mother nodded through the tears, her body limp as if all the fight had left her. Mom tried to shield Ginny from everything that came after, talk of bail, a court date, the seriousness of the charges her dad was facing, and murmurings about him staying at a motel in Beaverton. Earlier that night, Mom had had no choice but to drop her off at Grandma Cordero's, since no one else could watch Ginny. When her father showed up to his mother's house, he screamed at Grandma Cordero until she let him take Ginny with him. "She's my daughter. I'm allowed to see my goddamn daughter." "We're going to get ice cream," Daddy grunted, his yellowed, calloused fingers tapping against the steering wheel of the truck. "I just have to make a quick stop first." Ginny wondered what kind of ice cream place was open at 10:30 at night, but she knew better than to question it. Her father had never touched her, but she wasn't sure if someday that would change. Daddy pulled up outside the 7-Eleven and thrust the truck into park.
"Don't go anywhere."
Ginny knew better than to ask him how long he'd be inside. Was it enough time to make it to the payphone? She wasn't sure her dad was allowed to pick her up and bring her anywhere, and he'd obviously already had a lot to drink. "Okay." He left the engine running and swung himself out the driver's side, wincing. As he walked up to the store, past the boys with skateboards who were always smoking in the parking lot, Ginny noticed that his lopsided gait was getting worse. That fact, coupled with how foul her father's mood had been, made her suspect that his orthopedist wasn't prescribing him as many pain pills as he needed. Ginny looked in the side mirror, craning her neck to see behind her, at Jessie's gym across the street. When she was 4, her mother signed her up for toddler tumbling, and she'd liked it so much she wound up going to class 3 nights a week once she was old enough. She would have signed Ginny up for every class Jessie had to offer if they could have afforded it. Ginny knew she wanted to get her out of the house, away from her father. Ginny closed her eyes and smelled sweat and rosin. Heard her father squealing up to the curb outside Jessie's gym in his truck, nearly taking down the sign listing a sandwich special for the deli next door. When Jennifer Rayburn saw and marched off to tell Jessie what she'd seen, hair flying out behind her, all Ginny could think was that Jen was an angel. A blonde-haired, green-eyed angel. But then Ginny would get embarrassed, worrying about everyone else at the gym thinking she was a loser whose parents never picked her up on time or who showed up drunk. Her father had managed to ruin gymnastics, too. Outside the truck, someone was yelling. Her father was yelling. She'd recognize that sound anywhere. Ginny peered out the window. Her father was standing in front of a beat-up pickup truck. A man was leaning against the side, and one was seated in the driver's seat, his arm dangling from the window. Ginny swallowed back fear and lowered the window just enough to hear what they were saying. She caught her father mid-sentence.
"What's the matter with you?"
he was shouting.
"Those girls are less than half your age."
The guy leaning against the side of the truck laughed, clearly unthreatened by her father.
"Whatever, old man."
Ginny's blood ran cold as her father stood up straight.
"The fuck did you just call me?"
The driver of the truck stopped smirking. He opened his door, sending a flood of panic over Ginny. She lowered the window and called out to her father.
"Daddy, please, don't!"
The man standing outside the truck swung his head toward her. He gaped, then turned back to her father.
"You're standing there blitzed out of your mind, and you got a fucking kid in the truck?"
Ginny flitted back and forth between hoping the men would call the police and praying that her father wouldn't put his beer down and go after the driver. He may have been stronger than her mother, but this was a fight he couldn't win.
Daddy,
she pleaded.
Let's go, come on!
To her surprise, he didn't take another step toward the men in the truck. He hoisted his 12-pack of beer up and headed around to the driver's side of his own truck, while the other man got into his truck. They peeled off, leaving Ginny trembling in her seat.
I told you to stay out of shit like that!
Her father's voice jolted her. He tossed the beer into the back seat and slammed the door shut. Ginny's heart thumped as he climbed into the driver's seat.
I didn't want you to get hurt, she whispered.
Her father grunted. Ginny picked up the stench of beer on him that wasn't there when he entered the store, and she strongly suspected that one can was missing from the 12-pack in the back seat.
Those men were harassing some girls, he said. I don't like when animals like them look at girls like that. One of them could be you someday.
Ginny breathed through her mouth as he fumbled to put the truck in reverse. She didn't say it, but she didn't think there was a man out there who was more dangerous to her than her own father was. The rain was falling sideways in sheets now, one of those fall storms that shifts gears with little warning.
It's really rainy, Ginny said. It's too dangerous to drive.
It's too dangerous for you to drive. Daddy grabbed her by the chin.
Hey, look at me. Have I ever put you in danger before?
His words slurred together. Ginny shook her head. Her father released her, and Ginny felt a red spot bloom on her face where his fingers had dug in.
I don't put my family in danger. You're safer with me than anyone else. You got that?
Ginny nodded. She thought of the cell phone in the pocket of her father's jacket. If she could sneak it without him seeing. He leaned over and began to cycle through the radio stations. The moment his eyes left the road, the truck swerved onto the shoulder.
What do you think, the Stones or the Moody Blues?
Ginny squeezed her eyes shut.
What, now you're not talking to me?
Daddy whipped around in his seat to face her, jerking the car into the oncoming lane. Ginny grabbed the dashboard, seeing the headlights of the other car through the rain. She felt like she was leaving her body, like it was someone else screaming, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy! He yanked the wheel back, the sickening sound of the other car's horn, then the screech of metal on metal. Daddy slammed on the brakes and the truck spun a complete 360. Ginny felt the tires leave the pavement. They were falling, both of them screaming. Her skull cracked against the ceiling and then everything went still. Upside down. They were upside down. With trembling hands, Ginny unbuckled her seatbelt. Next to her father was motionless, blood trickling down his face. Ginny lowered the window and climbed out, the scene swirling around her. The truck had flown over the guardrail. The ground sloped below her, her feet sucking into the mud. The water from the lake below was rising with the rain. She stumbled up the hill back toward the road, her sneakers sounding like suction cups in the mud. She walked through the pain in her shoulder, or maybe her collarbone. She had never broken a bone before, but she imagined this was what it felt like. Help, I have to help them. Ginny came to a halt when the other car came into focus. It was split in half, the front end wrapped around a tree. When she saw a limb, completely detached from its body, lying on the grass, she stumbled forward and vomited. Both of the girls, Ginny thought they were girls, at least. In the car, were dead. That much was clear. They were dead because of her father. Or maybe it was her fault. She hadn't answered him when he asked what music she wanted to listen to, and he'd gotten angry and taken his eyes off the road. In both directions, there was only blackness and rain. Why wasn't anyone coming? Where were other drivers? Ginny ran back across the road, sliding down the embankment, grabbing onto branches as she went so she wouldn't fall. If she could get to her father's cell phone, she could call the police. That's when she heard him moaning her name. The film of vomit still sour on her tongue, Ginny climbed over the embankment. Her father had managed to lower his window. His face was purple from the blood rushing to his head.
"Ginny, baby,"
he said.
"I need you to unbuckle me so I can climb out."
Ginny looked from his arm, twisted at an unnatural angle, to the blood dripping from his forehead. She thought of Mom's eye, purple and swollen. Daddy's voice cracked through the pain in Ginny's skull.
"Now, Ginny, I'm fucking bleeding over here."
Ginny touched her eyebrow and examined her fingers, stained with blood. Her father's eyes were pleading.
"Come on, baby. You gotta help me out of here. I can't unbuckle myself."
All she had to do was reach through the window, undo his seatbelt so he could wiggle out the driver's window. The embankment was flooding, the truck teetering, threatening to topple into the lake. Daddy was screaming her name now. Thunder sounded over the lake, and she knew no one in the houses, if they were even listening, could hear his screams. She watched, one arm around the tree, as the truck rolled into the lake. Then she turned and headed back up toward the road, away from the sounds of the sirens approaching, disappearing into the rain. Hours later, when her mother got home and wanted to know why Ginny was lying in bed with a bag of frozen carrots pressed to her fractured collarbone, Ginny said her father had done it before he left. It was the truth, after all. She knew the image of that wrecked car would haunt her for the rest of her life. But what was there to gain from admitting what had really happened? Hadn't her father gotten what he deserved for killing those two girls? For hurting her mother, for destroying almost everything he touched? No, Ginny decided. She wouldn't tell anyone. There are some things not everyone has to know. This is Phoebe Strahl. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Cheerleaders by Kara Thomas. This program was directed by Maureen Monterubio, executive producer Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2018 by Kara Thomas. Production copyright 2018 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.